My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Welcome to the Venture is Human show. I'm your host, Mohamed Almeshika, founder and managing partner of Outliers Capital. In this show, I converse with thought leaders in the venture and investing world to unpack the human side of investing and company building. If you're a founder or an investor, you already know that investing is fundamentally a people's business. I explore that further with our guest today. All right. Well, Duncan, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Yeah, Mo, thanks for inviting me. I'm really happy to try to help you and your listeners out.
No, totally. It's always a pleasure to have you here. So Duncan is a serial entrepreneur who founded two unicorns. Currently, he's the founding partner of Bullpen Capital, the post-seed venture capital firm in Silicon Valley. They are investors in companies like WAG, Space IQ, Hologram, and many others. Duncan has a physics and math degree from Brown University and a JD in computer law from Michigan Law School. As I said, Duncan, very thrilled to have you here and have a conversation with you on the human side of venture.
Perfect.
Cool. So let's get right to it. Duncan, you've been in the venture ecosystem since the 1990s. And when we say a lot that early stage startups is all about venture and the human side, as a leader of a firm in the Valley, how do you coach investors that you have at Bullpen and how to assess and evaluate the human side? As from the outside, it might feel very subjective and very hard to evaluate. Would love to get your thoughts there.
I would put it this way. Venture funds have a culture. They differ. And the culture gets formed early and tends to persist a long time. We started off at Bullpen with a culture being founder-friendly, and we all had started companies collectively, I don't know, 10, 11 between us. And so we'd been on the other side and know how to deal with VCs. And part of the problem you have in a fund is over time, you see this Gaussian curve of situations, positive to negative. And you tend to then get very concerned if you start seeing the negative and try to guard against it. So the culture can get moved by experience to be more callous and more decisive and sort of almost more mean in a way of putting it. And because we started off with a founder-friendly sort of, we used to be there, culture, we've never gone that far, which is good. And so what I try to do inside of the fund is make sure people behave that way. Give you an example. We have a group called Fullpen that meets every month to evaluate some of the more interesting and difficult deals. It's a broader range of experience than we have, and we tend to get people with marketing or sales or some other specific experience to advise us. Sometimes it's vertical, like medical. Well, we had a problem a while ago in one of our full pens in that the full penners, the guests who are evaluating a company, would act like little VCs and come really hard onto the entrepreneur, trying to show that they were tough and they're asking the right questions. And it was not our culture. So we had to tell them to back off and had to do coaching of our own broader group. How you deal with people. And so anyway, I'm just telling you in general, when you go up against a venture fund, there's a culture you're dealing with when you talk to them, and they're going to behave well or poorly in it. What we worry about most of all, and what we've structured our fund to do, is to coach the CEO. So we find that over the course of being in a founder, when you do your own company, you find that being a CEO can be very lonely. The CEO might start off with a group of co-founders and their friends, but eventually he or she has got to make some really tough decisions, often against the interests of the co-founders. And it becomes a lonely position. So we try to position ourselves to be the trusted advisor to that person, particularly through the times, which are very difficult. And I think that's what you're trying to get at, Mo. How do you do that? And I've had some, in the last couple of years, COVID in particular, through some really difficult circumstances on all of our plates. In one case, the CEO was close to suicidal. Things weren't working out. In other cases, they were not dealing with the problem aggressively enough. And so a lot of our work was just coaching them. Or in the case where they really got too stressed, giving them some time off. So we almost played this, you know, bedside shrink to them to get them through it.
Oh, wow.
Some people rose to the occasion and some didn't. Yes, it's, you see a whole range of activities and personality types, and sometimes they go off the deep end and sometimes they rise to the occasion and perform superbly.
That's very interesting. You touched on the coaching on the mental side. I remember you once said that your favorite job was at Intertrust and taking them to an IPO. And what your favorite part was the range of emotion during that job. And it often said founders persevere through mental resilience. Can you unpack that a little bit? What did you mean with the range of emotions and that it was your favorite part? And how does emotion relate to a set of founders and investors?
When I was doing startups, the highs were really high and the lows were really low. There are times when you're about to run out of money, you want to go into your credit card to keep the company going, and you're at the very edge and suddenly you get saved. That's a low. There are times when you launch something and it doesn't work out like you expect and you've got to reshuffle the deck, and that's a low. And then there are highs. I mean, it's not just going IPO, but scoring a really big account and growing really fast. When you're in venture, when I went from startup side to venture side, instead of being high highs and low lows, it's kind of a little ripple. Oh, that was nice. Oh, that was bad. Oh, it didn't have the range of emotional ups and downs. And to some extent, I miss that, the excitement and the disaster, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat, whatever the phrase is. But the venture is much more like a ripple in the pond, not huge waves. But having seen and gone through it, you have to deal with that in people. And a lot of times a founder goes through what I call a learning cycle. They think it's easy. They're going up a positive move. They know how to do it. And suddenly it's not working. And then they go down, mentally down, in what I call the valley of death. And so they go down to the bottom. They don't know how to get out of it. They don't know what's going on. They're losing control of the company. And that's the moment. When you get to the bottom, the valley of death, because you were overconfident at the top, getting through that is everything. And so often that's when we have, as sort of CEO coaches, have to help people through the valley of death and see the way forward. And I'll give you one example, Mo, which I thought was very useful during COVID. COVID was a great reset for some companies. The expectations of growth went away. And what we told them was this: okay, you've been handed a gift. Often you start a company, you have certain assumptions, you build the product in a certain way, and you know if you could repeat history and go back in time, you would have built something different. All right, you now have a great reset. You can now build the product you know you should have started with. You can rebuild, you can reimagine, you can redo what you're doing. And we gave them, in effect, permission to do this. Founders sit in a position where they have venture people and they think, oh my God, I got to live up to the expectations of my investors. But don't live up to their expectations, I'll have a hard time in the future. And so they get trapped in my expectations, which they may be reading incorrectly. And I don't want them to think that way. One of the great reasons why you're a good founder or not is you're agile and you look at the reality of what you're dealing with and you can shift the whole company. And so we gave people permission to reimagine the product. And in a couple cases, they did. And what came out was a much better product that came out with much faster growth when they were done.
Interesting. So when you talk about expectations, how does a founder or an investor handle expectation management?
Well, you're supposed to, theory. There's an old saying by one of the great American philosophers, Yogi Berra, catcher of the Yankees baseball. And he said, basically, in theory and practice are the same. In practice, they're not. So the theory of the case is you go into a new company and you're in alignment. You got pitched, you invested, you all agree on the plan and the direction. And so you theoretically, theory says we're in alignment. But practice says, no, you're not. Often from a VC, you invest without full knowledge, and then you get better knowledge in the first or second board meeting. The VC line is, you don't know what you've got till the first or second board meeting. Then you know if you made a good or bad investment. Because what you're going to find out is, are you in misalignment with the founding team? Now, getting into alignment is extremely important. Otherwise, you diverge in expectations, and the founder lives up to the wrong expectations. And it's incumbent upon the VC to take charge of that, not the founder. And the investor has to let the founder know when they think they're out of alignment and on the direction. And that at that point, the founder's got a key decision to make. So the decision is, I know my business better than you, investor, know. I'm the one that has the right direction, not you. And then it's the founder needs to stand up to the investor and convince him that's the right direction to go in. And if you can't come together, then things are just going to diverge. Sometimes investors give up. I got a lot of investments. Screw you. I'm going off focusing elsewhere. And you sort of get abandoned by the investor. But at other times, you have this dialogue, and the founder may realize there's some things they're not seeing, and they get back in alignment. And usually that process occurs at the next round of money raising. Mm-hmm. And then, in other words, you see the pitch deck and you got to help them out with the pitch deck and you go through a discussion. And because of the practical reality of raising money, often the venture side can get the founding side to come back into alignment.
I think you touched upon something really interesting here is two points. And I'm wondering whether they're related or not. You talked about the valley of death where you start at a certain point and then you realize you're not there and you just got to persevere to get past this point. And then you talked about the misalignment. Do you escape the valley of death when you have the alignment, or are they two tangential points, not much related?
Well, the valley of death concept is a generic model. You can see this across a lot of industries and a lot of time with people. You go into a new project with confidence and enthusiasm, then you realize there's a lot you don't know. And that's when you start heading down into a mental valley of death where you're not sure how you're going to get out of it. So it's a general framework. And there's been a lot of learning on the side of organization development. How do you help a team work better and all that to find methods to manage a group and a leader through a valley of death? And I happen to be schooled in that early on in my career. And it's fascinating stuff. And it does seem to work. So most venture people don't think this way, but they go through it all the time without a framework to understand what they're taking the founder through. The misalignment often comes when you get near the valley of death as a founder, because the investor thinks they know the way out and you think either it won't work or there's a different way out. So you can often see the misalignment at the bottom, but you have misalignment in other cases too. So, Mo, let me give you what I think is the most effective way to get somebody out of the valley of death.
That would be great.
Particularly when fundraising is coming. What we tend to do, other than sort of coaching and keeping the entrepreneur sort of encouraged, we work a lot on narrative, the story. So, if you don't mind, I'm going to digress a minute. I think a lot of people say to a pre-seed company, the investor is going to look for product and market and team. Good team, big market, great product. Sure, that's all true, and that's table stakes, but it's not very interesting or insightful. What we tell the founders to do and what we look for is, what is your unique insight? Why this and why now? What is unique about what you're doing? And if they can articulate a unique insight, it frames the pitch or the narrative they make to the venture side of why they should be interested in this. So the reason I go through this is often a team, when it's going through a lot of work, day-to-day, selling, pushing, struggling, they lose sight of the unique insight that got them there. And so the process of recreating the narrative to pitch is basically recreating the unique insight that makes people interested.
Very interesting. So unique insights are often mentioned by investors, and they say, like, you know, experienced investors like yourself say, what is your unique insight? Founders typically ask, where do I get that unique insight from? Like, what are the sources of such unique insight? Can you double click a little bit on that?
That's a very interesting way to put the question, because why are you starting the company if you don't have a unique insight? There's a lot of fish in the sea. There's a lot of companies. Almost never is a company unique. Almost never do they not have lots of other competitors. Not necessarily directly competing, but competing for the same type of money from the same type of customer. So again, what is it that makes you unique in this giant ocean of other people? That's the key. And in fact, when you talk about like product market fit and some of the other phrases people use to describe, you got it right. When you have product market fit, your unique insight is working. Let me give you a stunning, and you know, it's sort of unfair because it's such a stunning example of unique insight. So software has always had a database at the bottom or a data structure. And database companies like Oracle can do really well because it's an engine for a lot of different applications. So SaaS comes along, and the people at Snowflake had a unique insight. There's going to be a cloud-based store for all the SaaS stuff. It's not going to be siloed in each little SaaS product. There's going to be a common core, a data warehouse, so to speak, for the SaaS world. Now, there were data warehouses in the past. Data warehouse was not unique. What was unique is, they argued, we can become the data warehouse of record of all the SaaS products inside of a company. Now, that's a hell of an insight. And that insight created a super unicorn. But that's what I'm talking about. They were the first to really put that together. Maybe other people had thought of it, but nobody had the articulation that we are going to be the database of record, the data warehouse across multiple SaaS products for the SaaS industry as everything goes to the cloud. Bam. That's what I'm talking about, Mo. You need an insight like that. And that's a really powerful one. But something where people can say, oh my God, if you pull this off, it's going to be huge.
That's amazing. You know, we're talking about the valley of death. And when you start at a moment where you think you know, then you realize you don't. And then you start to get a lot of learning. You know, you once commented on a recent funding announcement that you guys have done that the founders have a fast learning curve. When you evaluate founders at an early stage in their companies, how do you gauge out whether they have a fast learning curve or not?
Well, it's a great question. I have two companies that I'm thinking about through COVID that had a similar problem and opportunity in front of them. And the problem I would say is this. They were selling a SaaS product, both of them, different parts of an organization. But when COVID hit, they suddenly realized they need some management layer so that if you're, say, a sales manager, you can manage all the people that are now remote and dialing for dollars or whatever selling. You can sit on top of them and manage a remote workforce through the same product. Kind of an interesting idea. The first company, there were two young founders. They were Gen Z, which I call Zoomers, sort of early Gen Z, Zoomers. And they were voracious learners. So their style was to talk to the various investors, including us. What do you guys think? And we'd have a discussion, almost a philosophical discussion of what they should do or shouldn't do. And they learned from it. And by the end of the COVID period, they were kicking butt. And I said, you guys have graduated. I don't need to teach you anything. You've learned so much. The other founding team had a similar problem. But they went about it in a completely different way. They had a little tiger team. They tried to launch ideas. It was like restarting up. And I explained to them, you really need to do this management layer. That's what your customers want. Other people are doing it. And it's not that they resisted. They persisted in their process to figure it out. When we get to the end of the COVID period, company one is growing fast. Company two is growing slowly. There's often a phrase with dogfighting with jets, you know, inside their turning radius. The turning radius of company number two is way too slow. Their method was too experimental and not really pushing hard or making a bet. And they were throwing a lot of ideas out and see what would stick. Whereas the first company, their learning style was, okay, we're going to figure this out and we're going to go do it. And so their turning radius was much quicker.
And was there an element of talking to different people with different perspectives to be able to accelerate their learning curve? Would you say that's a determining characteristics of fast learning?
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. When we were investing in these companies, in a way, part of what you do when you get pitched is you view what's coming at you like an intelligence test. So for example, no company ever hit their business plan. They either massively exceeded it or massively failed it, but nobody hits the business plan. But the process of walking through the business plan, the numbers in particular, is an intelligence test of how well the founding team understands their business. And they don't understand it very well. Then you look at what their learning style is. If it's bluff, they're going to fail. They're trying to bluff the investor. And a lot of people do, but they're going to fail because their learning style is pugnacious. It's not experimental. It's not philosophical. It's just sort of, this is the way it's going to be. And they get stuck. And, you know, you can talk about founders being persistent or breaking through brick walls and all that, but that process is not one of being stubborn and pugnacious. It's a problem of trying to figure a way through the brick wall as fast as you can. So I could put it this way. The stubborn founders bang their head against the wall. It gets bloody. The agile founders find a way to go around the wall or pull the bricks out or something, but get through it in a clever way. That's learning style. And you can usually see that pretty early on.
Would you say there are some indicators that would indicate that they have that learning, fast learning style?
Well, the biggest one is they face the issue head on as opposed to bluff or try to fudge over it. In other words, if you come up with a problem with their plan and they deal with it in reality, yes, that's a real problem. We've understood that problem. We don't know a way out of it yet. You'd rather see that than, no, it's not a problem. You guys don't understand. You want to see them facing up to the issue. And that usually is indication that they're going to have a more rapid learning style.
I want to switch gear a little bit onto something else. Like you commented on one of the companies that you, you've invested in. And you said it pays to be contrarian. And there are like two notions in VC. One is you get better at venture by recognizing patterns and being able to act and action those patterns. And then there is like going against those patterns and being contrarian and it pays. Are those two notions that can be consigned together or would love to get your take on it?
I have to deconstruct your question and talk about the two aspects differently. So pattern recognition. Yes, VCs are pattern recognition engines. And there's been a lot of studies, one recently done by somebody over at Bessemer Ventures. And it's been written up in several publications where they systematically looked back of unicorn founding teams. So unicorn is sort of indication they succeeded. Let's look back and look at the characteristics of the team. And they were trying to compare it to the pattern recognition. And what they found, for example, was a fairly even distribution between top schools in the US, middle schools, you know, mid-level schools, or what I would call Chico State, you know, the schools that aren't Stanford or Harvard. And they found an even spread, that it wasn't that most of the founders came from the top schools. No. And about a third of them came from Chico State type of schools. Interesting. And so there's an even spread. And so the pattern recognition, two people in comp sci out of Stanford or Harvard must be good, turned out not to be a very strong indicator. Go a little further with this. I've talked to you about how Bullpen's approach is very metrics driven. Instead of saying good product, good team, good market, we start with the metrics. Well, if it's a good product and market, it should be showing up in the numbers. Customers are happy, you're growing fast, you have high retention and all that. One thing we didn't really realize at the time, we didn't do it for this reason, but looking back, we have a much more diverse founding basis than most venture funds because we're not doing the pattern recognition. We're sort of putting on a little green eyeshade like an accountant and looking at the numbers. And if the numbers look good, then we go back. Well, how good is the team? What's the product? What's the market? But we start with the numbers and we end up with a more diverse group of founders. And we're doing pretty well. I mean, I look at our number of unicorns, if that's an indicator, we're doing pretty well in terms of spotting crazy and interesting companies with founders that don't follow the normal pattern. So anyway, I just think the first part is the pattern recognition is more of a problem than a solution. But let's go to the second part of your question. Let me put it this way. When I think about how VCs look at companies, I'm going to give you three levels. Now, assume at every one of these levels, product, market, team are all important. They're like threshold items. Level one is unique insight. We talked about it. Level two, a little bit harder to do, are metrics. What is the market saying about their unique insight? Not what is my opinion. But then there's level three, and level three tends to be the pattern followed by the top venture funds. They're looking for the deeper narrative. They want, so assuming you get past product market team, and you have to, or you're not going to go any further, and then you have unique insight and you get funding on it, and then you show the metrics that prove the insight was good, or maybe it doesn't, you got to pivot and change up a bit. That's level two. But level three is the deepest level. And I'm going through this because I think this is what people really don't see when they're trying to raise money. Level three, again, I'll call it narrative. Do you have a way to articulate, to explain why you're going to be a superior company? The top venture funds invest on that narrative. They want a snowflake. We're going to be the SaaS cloud store of record, data warehouse of record. They want that. And usually it can be encapsulated in a very short statement. But the curious thing about this, that statement has got to be pretty contrarian. In other words, if it's not, there's only going to be one that's going to build this big market and we're going to be it, it's not going to be very compelling to the narrative side. So the contrarian thing comes out of unique insight versus an insight other people have. Very good metrics. And then, but fundamentally, you have a way of articulating what you're doing, which people think is wow. And sometimes it's simple. One of our companies is called Ipsy. It was competing with a company called Birchbox, which is selling a makeup sample box, mostly to young millennial women. And Ipsy comes along, and its unique insight is we can use fashionistas or YouTube to sell. Now, 10 years ago, that was stunning. Nobody was doing it. Everybody was trying to sell the Birchbox through digital Facebook or Google search words, blah, blah, blah. So these guys come up with one of the great fashionistas at the time, Michelle Phan, who had the highest number of followers for a while, and she sold the product. And they created a YouTube channel, early social influencer channel, and it was stunning. That is an example of a unique insight. But it's also and the metrics were stunning, but it's also an interesting narrative they built around it. And the narrative that was compelling and wasn't obvious is the following. Right now, you go to a department store anywhere in the world and you walk through this minefield of perfume and makeup, and you got to go past these booths and everybody's getting squirted with perfume. It's like, for a guy, it's like trying to crawl your way through a fog. But for women, you have a couple spots, maybe four spots, you can test perfume, then you're done. It's a way to discover products, but it's really time consuming. So the narrative is we envision this YouTube-oriented way to get samples of makeup and other beauty products as discovery. You don't have to go to the department store. That was the stunning narrative that worked. Because now they thought it wasn't just some cute little thing where you're trying to just do sample small products every month. This is actually the new way people will discover new products. Now, 10 years ago, this was all very, very new. Now it seems sort of, okay, yeah, we get it. So that's an example of where the level three narrative was what was stunning. They really understood what their business truly was. And it wasn't obvious at the beginning that was their business. It's not the way Birchbox would have articulated their business. We are a discovery like walking through a department store. No, they wouldn't have thought of that.
That's very interesting. And is being contrarian believing that narrative and putting the full force behind it? Or how would being contrarian relate to that narrative?
Well, I think what I explained to you was it's an old Wall Street trope, or it's a 2x2 matrix.
Yeah.
So one dimension is, are you right or wrong? The other dimension is, are you betting like everybody else or are you contrarian? So it turns out if you're wrong, you're wrong, you lose them both. So if you're wrong, you're wrong. So are you right? If it turns out you're right, but you're not contrarian, you're right like everybody else, you won't make as much money because everybody else will bid up the asset. Like, do you want to go into Dogecoin right now? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Everybody jumped on a few weeks ago with Elon Musk. But if you're contrarian and right, you make the biggest win. And contrarian in this sense means you invest on something you think is not the herd. You're not following the herd. Now, if you go wrap it all together, a lot of the problem with venture capital is you get a herd mentality. And too many people start companies that are 10% different, not unique, just slightly different. And you get this war of attrition of who gets the most funding, and you can wear down your 20 competitors, and eventually a winner emerges. That's not a contrarian way of doing things. That's the herd way. And if you think about it for a couple of seconds, you realize a lot of money is going to get lost doing that. Because even though one big winner may emerge, what about the 20 losers? And usually more money is invested in the 20 losers than is made, you know, at least invested in, if not made by the big winner. Whereas if you do something contrarian, you can just bypass all that war of attrition. And I can give you an example. We have a company called Grin that's in the area of influencer marketing. And there were a whole bunch of influencer marketing startups that were really agencies. We have a network of influencers. We can provide you the network. We'll help you do the creative. They're like a digital form of an ad agency. Well, Grin comes along and says, we don't want to do that. We want to be a SaaS tool for marketing departments, and they pick their network. Well, that is a contrarian bet because everybody else, or most everybody else, was doing the network approach, not the SaaS approach. And so Grin had just skyrocketed past all these people because they're selling something with this different narrative. We are the SaaS product to manage multiple networks. And again, when you hear me, I'm trying to give you examples because this narrative thing is not deep and complicated. It's clarity. But once you see it with clarity, you go, oh my God, yes, that's the right way to do it. But most companies don't go through the process to figure out what the real narrative is. The process of figuring it out is very insightful to a founder. Why are you different is another way of putting it. Why are you unique? And by definition, it's a contrarian bet then that you're pursuing.
Yeah, I think it's the saying that simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, I guess.
Yep.
Awesome. I think we can go on the conversation for hours here, Duncan. Like, I want to ask you three quick questions, if you don't mind. One is, do you have any like unusual habit that made you an amazing investor that you think most people don't know, or you kind of like developed that is very specific to the way that you do things?
Well, I'm going to put it this way. I'm going to answer your question more broadly. When Bullpen started, the three main partners had different approaches. It was in the combo of the approach that we came out with really good results. So for example, one of the partners likes entrepreneurs with a chip on their shoulder. And this is actually a very, very deep insight that he came up with. So the question I sometimes ask people, do you want to be right or do you want to be rich? Now, most founders say, I want to be rich, thinking, that's what I care about. Wrong answer. Wrong answer. You want to be right, which means you have a chip on your shoulder. There's something you're doing. And everybody said, don't do that. Become a doctor, become a lawyer. Do it this other way. Everybody else is doing it. They're all yelling at you saying you're stupid. You're an idiot. You're going to fail. Why are you wasting your life? And that develops a chip on your shoulder. I want to prove I'm right and they're wrong. That's why the answer to the question is, I want to be right, meaning I want to prove that my unique insight is correct. Everybody else is wrong. So he was very good at spotting that. And he likes to invest in founders that are edgy and have this I got to win type of attitude. The second partner was very intuitive. Older partner, spent a lot of time in and out of venture and startups. But he was very intuitive. And he often could read, this is going to be huge early on. So he's the person that came up with the narrative before the founder did. Oh, this is why you got to be big. That was very good. Now, my role was much more the analytical role. Okay, look at competition. Why are you different? How are you going to win? I was more that guy. But the three together was much more powerful than any one of the three all by itself. And I think we just stumbled on that.
A powerful combination indeed. A second question is, how do you stay sharp with all what is happening in the venture world? So many things from like latest SPACs to Dodge coins to all the way back to, early stage founders.
Well, that's a great question. I'll give it to you. I'll give you a historical answer about venture and then try to dive into it. If you go back to the US venture industry when it started in the 70s and 80s, the era were chips and PCs, hardware. And you could sit down as a VC and ask, what businesses will be created from the microprocessor? Because people asked that question and they answered it. And you ended up with around 40 possible businesses. And I think anybody could do it right now if they went through the mental exercise, but VCs did that. Okay, there's going to be this chip and that chip, disk drive, floppy disk, all the stuff from the PC era, word processing. And occasionally you miss something like nobody expected the spreadsheet. So it's a unique, wonderful thing that it comes out. When you go to the 90s in the dot-com era in America, the answer to the how many businesses was closer to 200. And no one VC can handle 200. So you had to have people inside of a fund that did their 40s. You might have five different areas you focus on. And so you could get ahead around 40 or so, but you couldn't do 200. So you had to either focus. In the current era, I think the number is more like 1,000. Businesses are being created, different business types. And a lot of them, nobody expected things out of the blue. So yeah. Looking back, oh yeah, that was an idea. But at the time, wasn't an idea. And so it's very, very hard to get on top of it now. So you can't just programmatically figure stuff out. Now, going back a little bit, the venture fund prior to this I was in, it was a big venture fund doing clean tech, among other things. And the clean tech people had built that chart. Here are the 50 clean tech businesses. There'll be this type of solar and that type and this type of battery. And they had the chart and they kind of like tried to fill in, let's get the best company in each one of our boxes. You could do that in a new category like clean tech, but you can't do that right now in the cloud. It's just way too vast. So how do you keep on top of it? Well, we do two things as a group and I do one other thing as a person. So the two things we do as a group is, we have this extended network of, we call them the full pen for bullpen, advisors who have expertise way beyond our own. And I think every venture fund does this in some way. And then you rely upon the expert in some pharma product, drug product, med tech, and they can tell you. So the second thing we do is we constantly try to replenish the analysts at the bottom of our fund. And so... there's an old Groucho Marx joke. I don't know if you guys know Groucho Marx, but he was a comedy team, the Marx Brothers, back in the 20s and 30s, and they did a bunch of movies. And there's one scene where a guy gives him a contract. He starts reading the contract. The party of the first part agrees with the party of the second part. He goes, I don't understand any of this. The guy giving the contract says, it's so simple, a five-year-old would understand it. So Groucho goes, okay, get me a five-year-old. And so the point of the story is, there's a lot of stuff coming up that Generation Z, the Zoomers, the Millennials, understand in a way that people that are in that Generation X or Boomers don't. And the recognition we have to make as an X or a Boomer is we get ourselves a five-year-old, go get a Millennial, go get a Zoomer. We need to have people coming in who understand that new generational thinking, and then we listen to them. So those are things we do structurally. The things I do individually, and all VCs do this, is read a lot. The people that get attracted to venture versus startups tend to be more intellectual. Because in venture, new stuff comes in all the time. In a startup, same old, same old, same old. And so if you have more of an intellectual bent, you naturally gravitate eventually into venture. But you have to feed your intellect by reading a lot and talking to people. And so you have to constantly replenish your learning, is the best way of putting it.
That's great. Ending with reading, what would be a book that you gifted the most?
Oh, gosh. Well, this is an interesting question because there's a lot of good books on venture capital, and you could read those books, and it won't teach you that much. Venture capital is an apprenticeship business where you got to go through it to understand. You can't intellectually understand it. You just have to be there on the front lines. So actually, I'd recommend people read books on history. Venture people are interesting. I think it's been looked at that about 2/3 of the venture people that are good are not engineers. Mm. If they went through operating roles, they came about the marketing sales side, not so much, or the legal side, not so much on the engineering software side. And why is that? They understand stories. Mike Moritz, one of the great investors in the 90s at Sequoia, used to say this to people, that he was a reporter, but he understood storytelling. If you understand stories, you understand how to craft a narrative, you understand how to read people better, you understand what's happened previously. So that is the most important thing to do. So the type of book to read on venture is not a book about the mechanics of venture, but it's stories on startups. What did they go through? What did they learn? What were the successes and failures? So for example, you could start with the Steve Jobs book. Everybody loves Steve Jobs. But you could read that book and realize what a character he was. And he had victory, he had failure, he had his own valley of death, and he came out of it. And it's a long book, but you really begin to see what the journey would look like. And you begin to realize a guy like Steve Jobs really had this unique insight capability. You know, it's kind of obvious looking back on it, but he really had it. Elon Musk has it. And you, by reading the stories of their lives, you begin to understand that the great entrepreneurs look at the world differently. And they're tortured human beings. They're not good people. Steve was mean to his, you know, daughter for many years and all that. They're not good people, but they have this unique way of viewing the world, and they can fashion things around them in a clever and amazing way. And, you know, again, I can give Elon Musk stories. They're pretty obvious. That's what I would do. I would try to learn about the lives of some of the top entrepreneurs and really understand what they went through. And I say really understand because everybody changes their history. When you hear the history of a company, it's all up and to the right, everything going good. No, it wasn't that way. There was failure and disaster and the edge of, you know, collapse, and suddenly you found a way out. But that gets rewritten out of history. History all looks like it's easy. You've got to go find that real history and then understand the journey of an entrepreneur.
Awesome. Well, Duncan, as always, a great pleasure to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Well, I hope this was helpful. I talked a lot. I hope something came out of this that was insightful to people.
No, it was amazing.
And you take care.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.